In 1956, a 25-year-old returned to Omaha with something more valuable than money, a set of principles that would transform American investing. Warren Buffett had just declined his mentor Benjamin Graham's job offer and instead gathered seven people at the Omaha Club, his father, sister, aunt, college roommate, and a few friends. Before accepting their $105,000, he handed them a document outlining his ground rules. No one knew these principles would generate nearly 24% annual returns for 13 years without a single down year. Bill Gates would later call these partnership letters the most important investment documents ever written. What made them so powerful? They weren't complex formulas or insider secrets. They were timeless truths about human behavior, market psychology, and the mathematics of wealth. Truths that remain as relevant today as they were in that Omaha dining room decades ago. Imagine a business partner offering to buy you out at wildly fluctuating prices, euphoric and expensive one day, depressed and cheap the next. Would his mood swings determine your business's actual worth? This is Benjamin Graham's Mr. Market, investing's most powerful metaphor. Markets price securities based on collective emotions, not rational value. Graham's insight: ignore Mr. Market until prices make sense. Buffett absorbed this at Columbia, transforming his perspective. Shares represent actual businesses, not ticker symbols. Short-term prices reflect voting, emotional popularity contests. Long-term returns reflect weighing, actual business performance. This mindset provides emotional insulation. A 30% price drop doesn't mean the business lost 30% of its value. The company still serves customers and generates cash. Mr. Market is simply having a bad day, creating opportunities rather than crises. Consider compound interest's power. Columbus's $30,000 voyage in 1492, invested at 4% annually, would have grown to $2 trillion by 1962. Small return differences matter enormously. Over 40 years, 8% versus 6% growth is worth more than twice as much. The S&P 500 delivered roughly 10% since 1950, yet average investors achieved only 2%, a catastrophic gap caused by poor timing, excessive fees, and emotional decisions. You can't control market returns, but you can control costs, turnover, and emotional discipline. Time becomes your greatest ally when harnessed properly. Would you rather shoot a 4 on a par 3 or a 5 on a par 5? Buffett used this golf analogy to show that relative performance trumps absolute returns. A year when your portfolio drops 15% while the market plunges 30% beats one where both rise 20%. Buffett set an ambitious benchmark: beat the Dow by 10 percentage points annually, yielding roughly 15 to 17% returns that would transform $100,000 into $1.6 million over 20 years. He warned partners to expect variability, potential 10% underperformance in difficult years, 25% outperformance when conditions aligned. He insisted on measuring results over at least 3 years, preferably 5. Most investment managers charge around 1% of assets annually, regardless of performance. Hedge funds typically charge 2% of assets plus 20% of profits, even when merely matching market returns. Buffett's structure was radically different. He charged zero management fees, earning only 25% of gains exceeding a 6% annual return. If the partnership returned 5%, Buffett earns nothing. If it returned 10%, he took 25% of the 4% excess. He implemented a high-water mark, requiring recovery of losses before resuming fees, a provision most modern hedge funds lack. Most importantly, Buffett and his family were the partnership's largest investors, ensuring his personal wealth rose and fell with his partner's fortunes. Buffett's partnership strategy centered on generals, a concentrated portfolio of undervalued securities. He initially favored Graham-style cigar butts, tiny companies trading below liquidation value. These weren't quality businesses, but extreme cheapness virtually guaranteed returns. After 12 years, this approach maintained the best win rate, with profits exceeding losses by 50 times. Graham's method targeted securities below liquidation value, companies worth more dead than alive. These net-nets offered massive safety margins, with current assets minus all liabilities exceeding market price. Buffett sometimes found companies with negative implied business values, as if the market paid him to own profitable operations. As assets grew, Buffett expanded beyond pure Graham plays, creating generals, relatively undervalued, larger companies trading at discounts to peers. Unable to acquire control, he often hedged by shorting pricier competitors. The pivotal shift came with American Express. After a warehouse scandal tanked the stock, Buffett recognized the core business remained intact. Customers still used their cards and traveler's checks. He loaded up, betting temporary panic created permanent value. This marked his evolution from buying fair companies at wonderful prices to buying wonderful companies at fair prices, a transition that transformed Berkshire Hathaway into one of history's greatest success stories. When Company A announces it will acquire Company B for $50 per share, B's stock typically jumps to $48, not $50. That $2 gap reflects deal risk and time value. Buffett's workouts exploited this spread by analyzing whether announced transactions would actually close. Traditional arbitragers spread investments across 50 or more deals. Buffett concentrated on 10 to 15 carefully selected situations, allowing deeper analysis and larger positions. This produced roughly 20% annual returns over 65 years, though with volatility. 1967's unexpected complications yielded just 0.89%. Workouts served a crucial strategic purpose. They were largely uncorrelated with market movements. During the 1962 crash, when the Dow fell 27%, workout positions generated positive returns. Buffett typically allocated 30-40% to workouts, increasing during rising markets for protection, shifting toward generals during declines when valuations became attractive. He never acted on rumors, only public announcements. Control investments were necessary means to optimize capital when passive investing wouldn't suffice. After buying Dempster Mills shares from 1956, he acquired 70% control in August 1961 at roughly a 50% discount to working capital. He fired the CEO and brought in Harry Bottle, who liquidated unnecessary inventory and equipment, transforming assets into cash. For these cigar butt controls, Buffett employed Graham's conservative valuation, 100% for cash, 80% for receivables, 67% for inventory, just 15% for fixed assets. Wall Street defines conservatism backward. Buying overpriced blue chips is deemed safe because everyone does it, while concentrating in deeply undervalued securities is risky because it's unconventional. Buffett argues true conservatism stems from correct facts and sound reasoning, not crowd following. Social proof, our instinct to follow others, becomes the muse of the underworld underworld because it kills outperformance. If something is rational, it's conservative, regardless of convention. Invest only when important facts are fully understood and the course of action is obvious. Otherwise, pass. Diversification benefits largely run their course after 6 to 8 uncorrelated businesses. In 1965, Buffett amended his ground rules to allow up to 40% in a single security when combining extremely high probability of correct reasoning with very low probability of value change. He later advised students, "If you can identify 6 wonderful businesses, that is all the diversification you need." The proof, during the Dow's 3 down years in the partnership era, Buffett was cumulatively up 45%, while the Dow fell 20%. Never having a down year across 13 years proved concentration, when based on sound reasoning, is more conservative than conventional diversification. In 1968, Buffett achieved his best results, a 58.8% gain generating $40 million. Yet, he announced the partnership's liquidation in May 1969. Why close at peak success? he'd run out of suitable ideas as speculation overtook the market. The go-go era had transformed investing into a game Buffett refused to play. Conglomerates like Lytton and ITT acquired low PE businesses while maintaining their own high multiples, creating illusory growth through questionable accounting. Wall Street celebrated this financial engineering. Buffett recognized it as fraud. His emotional intelligence shines through this decision. Rather than chasing trends, he maintained his standards. Understand the investment and ensure it's priced right. Otherwise, pass. This discipline served him well as the go-go era ended in spectacular crashes. When closing the partnership, Buffett recommended Bill Ruane to partners wishing to remain in equities, feeling morally obligated to guide them rather than abandon them to the most persuasive salesman. Taking Berkshire's helm in 1970, he gained permanent capital and the ability to move it tax-free between companies while maintaining the partnership mentality. The ground rules weren't just investment principles, they were a philosophy about integrity, rationality, and the courage to stand apart. The question isn't whether these principles work, Buffett's track record proves they do. It's whether you have the independence to follow them when everyone does something different.